Statistically speaking, the way I feel right now, I have the feeling this might actually be a somewhat short class because we're supposed to be finishing up strong focusing today, quote unquote, and that is chapter 5 of the text. And I covered a lot of things, and I feel like I covered a lot of territory last class. I'm one of those people that in public speaking, there's a rule of three. You guys know the rule of three? Whenever you're doing public speaking and giving a talk or giving, you know, even teaching a class, tell them what you're going to tell them. Tell them what you told them. And people tend to remember things if you tell them three times, right? So people tend to remember things if you tell them
three times.
Okay, good. So you see, you only remembered them two, so we're all done. There's the and so I oftentimes tend to go back and reiterate stuff again and again. Plus, we only meet twice a week, and some people had very hectic weekends, and some people had birthday parties, and random stuff like that. So what have we covered? We've covered lots of different things, actually. We've covered, we've covered Hamiltonian dynamics.
Not seeing that, Todd. Did you punch up the laptop HDMI?
I punched up laptop HDMI, yeah. So we can see it on the front screens here. I think I might have accidentally exited from the session here somehow. I've got sources in the front here at least, so we can see it in the front.
Right. Yeah. Hit exit down at the bottom right.
Right.
Yep. And hit it again.
Okay.
Cisco two-way meeting. It's the top left button.
The top left button. Codec TV 1, Cisco. There you go.
All right.
Is that better?
Let's see if you can hit laptop HDMI and see if it will change on all four monitors. Is it thinking?
We got it on one monitor.
All right. Hold on a second. I will come up there. Hold on.
Okay. Quick, while he's not looking, let's put it on the other monitor. Shh. I touched some buttons. So we talked about Hamiltonian phase space. You learned early on kind of a lot of things of history of accelerators, and even things like, cyclotrons and betatrons. But the Hamiltonians and phase space stuff and the magnets, right? And magnets and magnet construction. And you guys do have that homework that is posted on the class website that is in principle due on Thursday. If you want to stick it in my box after that, that's fine considering the backlog of grading I have to do. That's no surprise, at least. So we're taking these things together. And what we're doing is we're looking at now, starting to assemble and describe and characterize real accelerator systems, at least real magnetic transport systems.
There it goes.
Oh, woohoo! Look at that. Cool. Three out of four ain't bad. The other one will come up eventually, huh?
That one is me.
Oh, that one is you. Ah, there you go. Okay. So now what we're doing is we're fundamentally talking about transport systems and focusing in particular. And that is because I've got my accelerator here. Let's say this accelerator is some source of particles. Those particles tend to come out not like a perfect laser beam where all the particles are going exactly in the same direction, but they tend to have some speed, but they're all kind of going in different directions. And so what we need to do is we need to take those particles and we need to be able to focus them somehow and put them through focal systems that carry them through large places so that at the end of the day or at the end of the long path that they're going to, they all end up, you know, hitting something at the end that we want them to hit, whether it's a cancer patient or a target in an experiment or some piece of food that's being irradiated, whatever it happens to be at least. So the question is, how do you use what we've learned about the dynamics of particles moving through simple systems and magnets and magnets and more magnets and more magnets? These are magnets and things like magnet construction, really, is what I meant to say there. So in trying to solve this problem of how do we get our particles from here to there in a reasonable and consistent way, we've come up with the problem now that the magnets that we have, we can't make them focus in both directions, both horizontal and vertical, at the same time. We can only make them focus in one direction at a time, of course. So figuring out these systems now of alternating focusing if there is one kind of accelerator principle or optics principle that you walk away from this class with, it's this principle. And it's a principle that even, gosh, you know, some fifth graders know from building their own microscopes or telescopes. You put a focusing lens and a defocusing lens together and you can make interesting optical things happen. Well, here, if I keep on assembling those and repeating these again and again and again, I can make that interesting thing happen in periodic ways. So we're describing these periodic optical systems. And so what we're actually trying to do is I write down 2x2 matrices describing these or 4x4 matrices. We had learned about all of those for the magnets and the phase space for the quadrupoles and the drifts and the dipoles and started assembling them by multiplying those matrices together to describe our particle motion through these systems. Now what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the solutions to these things that obey periodic boundary conditions. These are the most interesting kind of solutions. They're also the most relevant types of solutions in the sense of if I take my particle beam, let's say I've figured out what the periodic optical solution of this system is somehow. And this periodic optical solution of the system ends up repeating itself again and again. It doesn't grow, it doesn't shrink, it has exactly this character. And I put my particles in a way that they fit these initial conditions. So I arrange it so that my incoming beam looks like the boundary, looks like the periodic condition of the optical system. Everything is great because I know by definition my particles will move in this periodic envelope through the system infinitely far. I could make a set of magnets, you know, a 1,000 kilometers long or something like that. My particles would go from one end to the other. And as long as it was periodic, the particles would ride this thing periodically and everything would be fabulous. This principle of finding these periodic solutions, you see in solid state physics, you see in quantum mechanics, you see it all over the place in physics. So there are deep connections here, this philosophy of taking a potential, like, you know, just like solids and solid state and phonons or sound waves moving through your crystalline material, or looking at the crystal from different perspectives and shooting your electrons into it and watching them scatter and getting an idea of what the crystal structure looks like in crystallography, all of this stuff is essentially connected. It's the same type of problem cast in many different physical ways. Ours just happens to be a little bit simpler than some of the others because it's kind of intrinsically two-dimensional. We only talk really here about X and Y. And then we talk about, well, X prime and y prime. You can think of these as positions, and these as velocities. Okay, and I'll put quotes around velocities, because what they really are they really are momenta. And in fact, remember, something like x prime, we really defined as the transverse component of the momentum divided by the total momentum. So that's kind of a dimensionless momentum thing, but it still acts like momentum. And whenever you're talking about dynamical systems, you're talking about F equals ma, which is second-order differential equation. Solutions to second-order differential equations need two constants of integration, or two initial conditions. That's why we have position and momentum, or position and its first derivative, is because those are the natural initial conditions describing a particle moving through this potential, moving through the system. Okay? So this is very, you know, this reminds us of the big picture of where we are, and we'll come back to this kind of again and again over the next class or two, just because it is easy to lose sight of the physical interpretation and why are you writing down these equations and looking at these things this way. It's precisely to get periodic solutions of the types of motion that particles would encounter going through these periodical optical systems. And the same thing goes, well, instead of making my periodical optical system that goes 1,000 kilometers, I can make it go in a circle, right? And I can start describing now my particle going through the same sets of magnets again and again and again through different types of accelerators that are circular. In particular, synchrotrons, which we'll talk about, which, like cyclotrons and bathytrons, all of those are circular systems. But circular systems have their own periodicity, too. So far, so good? All a reminder, right? So, been there before, we'll be there again, probably. So we had talked about all of the matrices. We had gone through at the very end of the magnet chapter that neat Lie algebraic way to figure out the transformation of particle coordinates through a sector bend, which was not at all obvious, at least. And that was, That was that type of a magnet where the incoming and outgoing particle trajectories are perpendicular to the edges of the magnet. It literally looks like, you know, a slice of a circle cut out. That's why it's called a sector bend, at least. And then we had really reduced all of these things to these thin quadruples, and I had gone through the concept that, okay, in a drift, what's really happening is the space is shearing along x. Positions change, angles don't in a drift. And in a quadrupole, a thin quadrupole at least, you can see from this equation right here, positions don't change. The outgoing and incoming positions are the same because there's a zero there. But by gosh, the angles change instead. So there's a shear in the x prime direction rather than the x direction from a thin quadrupole. So using these principles from Hamiltonians, using these principles from the kind of the matrix description of the dynamics, at least, we ended up with also some criteria on what our assembled optical system has to look like. So I can start building up a system of alternating drifts and quadrupoles back and forth, multiply all those matrices together. Remember, I mean, just multiplying three of these together is already algebraically tedious. What happens if you multiply four of these together? Well, let's do that for a second. Maybe not do it all the way, but point out some things that we will use in just a moment. So in the notes, there is the somewhat slightly tedious approach, which is to look at this optical system. And there is a, so this is a quadrupole. This is a drift. And let's, instead of calling us a quadruple, because this guy's a quadruple too, let's call this guy a focusing quadruple. Instead of calling this guy a quadruple, let's call him a defocusing quadruple. So in the x direction, the system looks like this. In the y direction, things look like this. Okay? Now, just because you want to be able to pronounce these things, it's funny, because I call this an F and I call this a D. I'm going to call the drift in the middle, since I already used a D for this, an O. Like, there's nothing there. It looks like a zero. It's an O, at least. Now, this system by itself, if I go from the front to the back, I can't really make it periodic, because it starts on an F and it ends on a D. However, if I add another drift at the end, and then draw a dotted line here, I could now start to look at an optical system where there's another focusing, another defocusing, et cetera, et cetera. And I could, in fact, produce a periodic piece that is what we call a cell. Okay. And I can take this piece and I can reproduce it again and again. I could stop it, for example, just before this first quadruple, and then plug another piece in right there where that quadruple and that defocusing quadruple repeat and keep on going on and on and on. So here's, you know, another cell of length L, of length, sorry, 2L. So now I can actually write down what the matrix of this system is, right? And this matrix of these things, let's call this the matrix of that total cell, is equal to what? Well, okay, in the horizontal direction as I come in, what's the first thing I hit? It's a focusing quadruple, right? So I'm going to have to write down a focusing quadruple there. And then the matrix of a drift, and then the matrix of a defocusing quadruple, and then the matrix of a drift again. This is one way to write this matrix of the cell, going from the very start of a focusing quadruple to the end of the last drift before I repeat again. And if I, you know, were to look at this thing and take it to the nth power, by gosh, you know, this would in fact look like these things to the nth power as I multiply them out. Now you might say, why did I write it backwards this way? Well, remember, these things are really operating on coordinates. And the first thing that's going to transform these coordinates is the first matrix to the left of those coordinates. And that just happens to be the focusing quadruple. So when I write out these matrices and actually multiply them out, be really careful about that order. So far, so good. So now, well, I multiplied three of the matrices already in the slides. So multiply by another drift, and I get the full matrix for the full system in the slide again. But this is only one way of looking at the cell, okay? There is nothing that prevents me. So I could multiply them all out like this. Fine. And I can't do any funny games with these. I can't necessarily rearrange them. Remember, matrices don't commute. If I want the full 4x4 version, I have full 4x4 versions of these matrices with X's and Y's, with minus F's and plus F's, depending on whether or not I'm focusing or defocusing and things like that. But I also could, in fact, make this periodic cut just about anywhere. So it doesn't have to be just at the beginning of this first quadruple. In fact, if I make that periodic cut exactly here, then what I've done is I've kind of exchanged X and Y, right? This the Y portion looks just like the X portion did for the original guy, and vice versa again. So that tells me something. That tells me, first of all, by slicing these things apart in various ways, I'm actually going to end up getting different M matrices. even though this is a completely periodic system, when I write down all of these matrices out and multiply them out, I'm going to get different answers whether I slice here or slice there.
Is that equivalent to like a phase shift?
It's exactly what it is, it turns out, right? So that long haul to a short slide is to get back to something that was mentioned in the last lecture. And that was when we parameterized all of these things, when we went through that version of Hill's equation, which is another way of looking at the motion, that second order differential equation with the periodic focusing in the system, and parameterized things certain ways and got down to a solution that had this periodicity here. Remember, I pointed out in the last class, there are some things that are global parameters. This phase doesn't depend on where I cut. It doesn't depend on where I started and ended the periodicity. But by gosh, that alpha depends on zero, my choice of S0. That beta depends on my choice of S0. That gamma, which is 1 plus alpha squared over beta, also has an S dependence, also depends on where I do that cut. Okay? So by doing these things, by doing those cuts, let's work through one particular example now. I don't even need to copy that down because I can have both of these available to me. But let's take the system now and let's look at one particular way of slicing it, and a way of slicing it that has some nice symmetry and has some nice beauty to it. Okay? So now, this is kind of like a half of a focusing quadrupole. And this is a defocusing quadrupole. And this is a half of a focusing quadrupole again. And this is now my cell, my periodic system that I'm looking at. Different people use L, different people use L over 2 in here. It all depends on, you know, it's all just a matter of bookkeeping. I used L in the class notes, so I'll keep that to L right now. Let's actually write this thing out now. And this is the matrix going from there to there. Okay? So the matrix going through this system happens to be, well, what's the last thing I go through? It's a half of a focusing quad. This thing is now symmetric, so I don't need to worry about which way I wrote down these things, at least. That is a 1, a 0, and let's call the focal length of these things F, for a little f. A focusing quadrupole has a minus 1, and now this is only half strength, so there's a 2f down at the bottom. Right? It's like I have twice the focal length, half the strength of the quadrupole. There's a drift in here. Now here is a full-strength defocusing quadrupole. And the defocusing quadrupole has a plus instead of a minus there. Another drift. And another half of a focusing quadrupole. Now you can see just how horribly messy this thing gets if you use thick quadrupoles. There are sines and cosines in there, and then you have to use sine-cosine formulas to add together all of the phase advances and stuff like that. This is one reason why people love these thin elements, and also because in real accelerators, at least, remember the constraint for these systems to be optically stable was that these focal lengths kind of had to be longer than the space between the magnets. So naturally, you're going to use the weakest magnets you can because stronger magnets are harder and harder to build. So let's multiply, you know, some of this stuff out at least. So there's a 1 minus L over 2F, There is an L, and then there is the stuff at the bottom. Okay, the stuff at the top stays the same because I'm multiplying by a 1, 0 in here. And then the stuff in the bottom, and now this starts to get, you know, this starts to get complicated, right? A minus 1 over 2f, that's not 1/2 f, but 1 over 2f. I shouldn't be so cavalier about these things. So I'm starting to get f squareds coming in here as well, right? So there is this term times this term is a 1 over f minus L over 2f squared, right? And then there's a minus 1 over 2f. Right, and a 1 over f minus 1 over 2f is a 1 over 2f. So I get a 1 over 2f minus L over 2f squared. And then this term times these terms is a 1 plus L over f. And you start to, you know, you start to realize that your entire life is going to be spent just plugging this dumb stuff into Mathematica because you don't want to do it by hand. I have everybody do the original photo cell by hand, and some classes I do it just to prove just how error-prone the damn thing is, right? It is very easy to make a mistake just multiplying 5 2-by-2 matrices together with a bunch of zeros in them. But okay, that's a long haul to prove a point, at least. So we end up getting something, and we end up getting something that looks like, you know, a bunch of terms, right? A bunch of terms that depend on L's and F's. But we also proved, or we also showed at some point, that because it is, oops, there we go, go back to VGA. Because this is a periodic system, it is going to have a certain form, and it is going to have a certain form. Duplicates alert, oh no. This is just one of those days for me, apparently. So this complicated stuff of L's and F's, all of the geometric things related to how strong the quadrupoles are, how long the drift spaces are between them, is also, by definition, got to be equivalent to that form, which is a form that looks a lot like Euler, as I was talking about at the very end of last class, right? This kind of a rotational system that, at the very end of last class, I said let's see if I can get back to being able to page forward in this. There we go. At the very end of last class, I showed that this form that we got, kind of a general parameterization from periodic focusing in a second-order differential equation, Newton-like thing, had this form of cosines and sines, and if you broke it out, you got down to an I times a cosine of some phase plus J times a sine of some phase, which looks a lot like Euler, particularly since that J squared term from the differential equation, if I square that J, I end up getting some alphas and some betas and that gamma, and using this relationship of this definition of what gamma was, everything magically falls out and J squared ends up being minus I. So this matrix, this complicated, horrible, painful matrix with L's and F's in it, also can be parameterized and written in this way. And then you can start connecting, gosh, this is the dynamics of the system, these betas and alphas, a general solution of a periodic differential equation to something derived from the matrices and talked about in terms of the construction of the accelerator, which is how strong the quadruples are, how far they are apart from each other. So let's go back to this. So this thing is a function of the Fs and the Ls, and it's also kind of a horrible function of the Fs and the Ls, but it also happens to be this function now. I'll write it in this, you know, rather beautiful way. Okay. Which is this kind of, let's say, I cosine mu plus j sine mu. And this j now depends, the only dependence of where I've made this cut. Because remember, if I do this M matrix, you can say that this is M1. If I do this M, or let's call this MF, because I calculated this in the middle of a focusing quad, if I do this MD and I cut this system in the middle of the defocusing quad, I'm multiplying different matrices together. I'm clearly going to get a different function. But it turns out that it reparameterizes. The only change in this parameterization is all contained only within this one J term, only within the alphas and the betas and the gamma, which is related to those guys.
So if you have, because you were speaking of periodic systems, and I guess extrapolating the matrix to an nth power, if you change where your cut is in a finite system, won't that make cells prior to your cut not equal to the cell you created? Does that make sense?
So I see what you're saying, and you're actually getting to part of the next point.
Oh, okay.
Okay. No, which is perfectly fine. Remember, I had said, you know, rather blithely back here, that part of my point was to arrange my particles or set my particles up so that they kind of matched into this periodic system. And match is, in fact, technically the term that people use. If I've got this, you know, the size of these particles and this divergence of these particles. Now, if they came in but they had a horribly different divergence, they clearly wouldn't move through the system periodically because they're coming in just spreading out way too fast for the system designed to focus that beam periodically anymore. You have to. It's like you're not in your initial beam does not look like it came from an infinite periodic system coming up beforehand, because it's not matching the periodic boundary condition, right? So actually, a great deal of the work that accelerator physicists do, at least in the day-to-day instance of running a real particle accelerator, is fiddling magnets to try and make the beam match periodic boundary conditions. And when you design systems, what you can do is I can say, oh, I've got one system that has a certain periodicity over here, another system that has, by design, a certain periodicity over here, but they're different periodicities. How do I now design a finite set of magnets in the middle that takes gracefully this periodicity to that periodicity and moves particles from here to here without mismatching all of the boundary conditions? Okay? Those types of things are called insertions. We'll learn about that next chapter. That's part of lattice exercises, okay? But that is, in fact, exactly kind of the bread and butter of the first part of the class. In fact, when I teach this course as a graduate class, we teach the entire course in 2 weeks. In the end of the first 2 weeks, we've done insertions. That's kind of my objective. So if we happen to hit insertions by the time of the midterm or by the halfway point of this class, and you have some idea, some feeling now for how you're designing magnetic systems, not just to be periodic and talking about it in terms of these betas and alphas, but also gaining an idea of, oh, I can design a magnet system to go from this periodicity to that periodicity, or go from this accelerator to that accelerator, because by gosh, you know, accelerators kind of all move particles amongst each other. You're really getting there, right? That's really a lot of what linear accelerator physics is about, and it's also the reason I get excited and hop up and down and try and make that a carryaway perspective point, is because matching boundary conditions like that also carries over to quantum mechanics, also carries over to solid state. How many of you have taken quantum or are taking quantum? Are you taking quantum or have you taken quantum?
Taking part two.
Okay. So you've already done like particle in a box and stuff like that, right? So particle in a box, there's, you know, in a square potential, you have to match boundary conditions between the exponential decay outside the box or outside the potential and the periodic system inside the potential. And matching boundary conditions, that's all this is, okay? It's just matching periodic boundary conditions with magnets instead of with wave functions. But it's very, very similar. In fact, I always kind of wanted to recast the two in the same light, because just like, I mean, wave functions are imaginary things. What's an imaginary thing? It's a two vector, real and imaginary part. What are these things? X and X primes. They're two vectors. Kind of, you could recast it as a real and imaginary part with boundary conditions, and it would look very, very much like WKB, right, or something like that. Anyway, so this is why this is a breadth course, and I like teaching this as a breadth course. It's not because you're going to run off and design your own particle accelerators, but you are going maybe someday to learn some, you know, look at another periodic boundary condition match and go, oh yeah, I remember Todd jumping up and down about this a lot in class. So let me get to a little bit of new stuff, because this is starting to move on into So the other thing that we do is we try and design our systems modularly. And it's hard to see my poor little magnets in there, but it's just like the drawing I had here of the half focusing, full defocusing, half focusing again. And that's my little picture of a cell, and this is a bunch of them glued together to make a semi-infinite periodic focusing system. And we try and design our accelerators in modular ways, because at the end of the day, they never work exactly the way you want them to, and you always have to be able to reach for controls in the accelerator to adjust something that makes a certain level of physical sense to you. And the physical sense is not how strong an individual quadrupole is or a focal length. The physical sense is, how is the beam moving through this periodic system, and how can I make it move periodically through that system. So this module is often called a photo module, focusing, drift, defocusing, drift again. And in fact, you can mathematically prove that this type of a system, if you're trying to get a beam from here to there, that if you have any other set of magnets, literally kind of almost any other set of magnets, at some point, the and let's say you're trying to get a beam from here to there, but you never want the beam to get too big. What's the optical system that will get the beam from here to there with a minimal beam size? Minimum, maximum beam size. Turns out it's this type of a system. Turns out it's photo, because it is kind of gently focusing in both dimensions. If I try and put more focusing in one dimension and I end up not getting enough focusing in the other dimension and the beam gets too big, either vertically or horizontally, if I didn't put enough focusing there. If I put too many magnets in there, what I'm doing is I'm really reproducing kind of this system with a shorter and shorter wavelength and making the focusing tighter and tighter, but it ends up being this system again. It's just more and more magnets or fewer and fewer magnets. So if I've got a constant number of magnets and I've got to get the beam from here to here, here to there, it ends up being the best compromise around. It ends up being having the smallest, largest beam size on average. So let's take this system, let's do that math. This is what I was trying to do by hand. It's actually in the slides now. Okay. And in the slides, I do all that multiplying out, and I do, in fact, do the awkward thing of using L over 2 instead of L like I was in these slides. Like I said, I think the textbook uses L over 2 here. And the reason that people use L over 2 is because then you can talk about L being the length of the cell. Half of it is before the defocusing, half of it is after the defocusing. So L is the cell length. That's the periodicity of the system. If you're going to build this with a bunch of Legos, that's how big your Legos are, so you know the natural yardstick of what you're going to build stuff with. And multiply the matrices out, and you get this horrible thing that actually has like L squareds and F cubes and stuff like that in it. It really is something you plug into Mathematica to do, okay? So, but remember, I said that this matrix multiplied out, you can always recast in this magic form of these cosines and sines. And now you can also start to see how to connect the two, right? Let's say I wrote this matrix out in terms of L's and F's, but I want to figure out what the sine, what the mu's are and what the betas are and what the alphas are. It looks hard, right? You can't just take one matrix element and say that, okay, that transform that to L's and that gives me mu or something like that. The closest thing that I can get is if I know this upper right matrix element here, okay, I've reduced it now to a combination of a beta and a mu. But the magic thing really is if you look at the trace of this, the alphas cancel out, and all that I'm left with is 2 cosine mu. And mu, remember, this phase advance per cell, this amount that I move forward in the cell in this phase, doesn't depend on where I cut anything. In fact, if I did this math, you know, with a different cut, I'd still end up getting this number for that trace of the matrix as it was multiplied out. That's kind of magic already and kind of cool. So now I have this solution, and now I can figure out exactly what mu is. Mu is that thing. I can rewrite this in terms of, there's a cosine mu actually can be rewritten in terms of sine mu over 2 in this funny little way that lets me compare these two directly and take a nice little write a nice little formula that says the sine of mu over 2 is related to the geometric terms, L and F, in this way. That gives me a bound, right? The sine cannot be bigger than plus or minus, you know, bigger than plus 1 or less than minus 1. It has a specific domain. So that means that the system really only works and can only be cast in that optical way if L over 4 is less than F, right? So F has to be, the focal length has to be longer than half of the distance between these quadrupoles. And that, but once that happens, now I can find a mu, I can find a phase advance per cell, and I can find a periodic solution for the system. Okay, so far so good. So I found, I can write this down, and I can find, in terms of the way that the magnetic system is constructed, I can find the phase advance per cell, this mu, it's called. So now that I have mu, well, okay, now that I have mu, I can look at this upper left-hand, upper right-hand term. I know what mu is now. So now I can figure out what beta is, because I know this upper left-hand term from multiplying out the things in terms of L's and F's. So this M12, this upper right-hand term is beta times sine of mu. Well, okay. So now I can do this magic again and figure out, okay, what is this beta? And now remember, beta does depend on where the cut was. Right? If I do this magic, this part now, for a different slice of the cell, I'm going to get a different number. Why do I call this thing here beta max? Well, if I'm going through this optical system, where do you think the thing is going to be biggest, where it gets focused? In the middle of where it gets focused, as a matter of fact. If it was biggest anywhere else, it almost wouldn't make sense, right? It kind of, by definition, the beam has to be biggest. The particles have to have their largest amplitudes in the middle of this focusing element. So that's why I call that beta hat, beta max. And you work out the math, comparing this to this, divide that through by sine of mu, and use my little, sine mu over 2 conversion to L's and F's down here from the previous slide as well, and you get a nice, beautiful little expression for the maximum of that beta function thing. And we'll get into the physical interpretation of the beta function later on in the class. For now, it's just an important periodic parameter. It's related to the maximum size of the beam. If you cut in the middle of the defocusing lens and you do the same thing all over again, it turns out what you're really doing is you're just really flipping the sine of F, right? You can think of, I could almost do this exact same thing, just flip the sine of F, and that flips that to a defocus, to a focusing quad, and flips these two edges to defocusing. And now in the middle of the defocusing element, that's where my beam has kind of got to be smallest, almost by definition. And so what happens if I flip the sine of F? I end up effectively flipping the sine of this SIN sign over here. And this is now the formula for the minimum of that beta function. This is great, though. This is connecting physical parameters of the optical system with general descriptions of the periodic equations of motion, right? The betas are equations of motion. They came from Hill's equation. The L's and the F's are magnet things that you can calculate based on how many windings are in a magnet and how big the magnet is and all of that stuff. So you're getting close to, oh my God, being able to build an accelerator. Generally, because of this, I mean, if you look at this thing, it's kind of, there's a certain beauty to it, right? What's the dimensionality of beta? It's a length. Everything else is phases and sines and stuff, the dimensionless things. So betas are lengths, and betas must relate to how big the beam is, because it's got a length parameter to it. So that also means that I can now plot beta hat over L and beta min over L, versus my phase advance per cell. And what do I get? I get something that's kind of interesting and non-trivial. So the phase advance per cell, this is a plot that I really like, because it's that should not in fact be meters, that should be dimensionless, because this dimension here is scaled, right? Beta divided by the cell length. And beta min divided by the cell length. And this is a phase advance per cell. I will now tell you something that is that was told to me by somebody who was told it by a Nobel Prize winner, Ken Wilson at ODU, father of renormalization, who won the Nobel Prize for renormalization groups and stuff like that. Whenever you plot something, whenever you plot anything, do your damnedest to plot it in the dimensionless way. Because you will usually find great insights into things that are plotted in a dimensionless way. Because it kind of folds out all the scale factors and stuff like that. And it folds out all of the human bias, because a meter is a human bias. But on the other hand, there's only one length scale to this system. It's the length of the cell. So if I plot something else that has a length in it, plotting that divided by the length of the cell kind of folds out that scaling and shows me some deep insight, right? So here I'm plotting something dimensionless, these things divided by the length of the cell. Now, with respect to the phase advance per cell, which is kind of already a dimensionless thing too. So if there's almost no focusing, you see that what happens is things blow up. No surprise. As a matter of fact, you look at these equations. If you plug in zero for mu, you get infinite values. Makes you happy. No focusing, beam blows up, no periodic solution. Boom. Dogs and cats live together, you're done. Right? So, on the other hand, if I have 180 degrees phase advance per cell, it turns out that things also blow up. Right? I get 180 degrees phase advance per cell, you know, these things also blow up as well in very unhappy ways. So dragons, you know, live out there. And, okay, I can get, you know, kind of infinitely small, beam at its smallest, but by gosh, at the sacrifice of beam at its largest is infinitely large. So everywhere in the middle, now you can actually see there is, in fact, even, because it blows up here and it blows up here, there must be some perfect optimum in the middle where the slope is zero. And you have, it ends up being, I don't know, 70, 68 degrees, some number. You can do the derivative if you want, at least. It's a nice kind of, you know, roundish number. But this is kind of the best you can do in terms of that scaling factor, that beta max divided by the cell length, at best is 2. I can make the minimum beam size considerably smaller if I add more focusing at the expense of making the maximum beam size a bit bigger. Or I can make the beam kind of roundish if I weaken the focusing and bring those two closer and closer together. So you can think of this optical system now. Now I've got kind of one knob, phase advance per cell, and I can, if I ease up on it and don't really focus things too much, I can make the beam kind of, you know, soft and roundish in both dimensions and roughly kind of even. It doesn't really get too big or too small. Or I can add lots of focusing and the beam gets big and small and big and small and big and small, but it's still periodic. So now I've got kind of this knob, whether it's maximum to minimum beam size ratio, which you can see certainly varies a lot, or it's phase advance per cell. However you want to describe it is fine, right? And you can see way back, I guess, in the class website, those animations that I have, of course, these things are going through this kind of a periodic focusing system. And now you can start to even guess, oh my gosh, you have the math. There is kind of a minimum and a maximum beam size plotted against each other on some axis. You have kind of a beta max and a beta min. You could almost guess from this and from rough, you know, hold up your thumb and scratch down some numbers things, exactly kind of what phase advance per cell I had used to construct this lattice. And I can tell you that it's something that it's somewhere in between. It's somewhere around 70, 80, 90 degrees per cell. It is not 30. It is not 120, because 120, the ratio of minimum to maximum beam size would be a lot bigger, and 30, the ratio of maximum to minimum beam size would be a lot smaller, and the beam would kind of look round all the time. Here it kind of does this just elegant little dance between between horizontal and vertical, and that ratio between minimum and maximum beam size happens to be, well, you know, 2, 1.8, something like that, roughly, give or take. But as you vary the optical system, it's going to change. So I'll give you guys some things to play with there. So what does a single particle do in this system, though? This is the truly funny thing. And this is this is a picture taken from the textbook, and I annotated it a lot. This is figure 5.3, and I always believe that things were not self-evident just by drawing this picture. So this is one of our particles going through now a long focusing channel, where it's photo, right? F drift, D drift, F drift, D drift. And these kind of sawtooths at the top and bottom are the betas, right? So the beta, particularly the maximum, this is the contours of the square root of the beta function. The beta function goes up and down and up and down. And the beta function has that periodicity of our focusing system, right? This is the beam size is maximum of the focusing quadrupole, just like I said, and a minimum of the defocusing quadrupole. And then because the system is periodic here and you have multiple periods, right? You got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 periods of this focal system. And you had to launch a particle through, and that particle ain't going through 10 oscillations. It's going through 10 periods of the focusing system, but the wavelength is really long compared to the wavelength of the periodicity of the optical system. And that's because, remember, the focal lengths of the quadrupoles are much longer than the spacing in between the quadrupoles, right? You're trained to think in optics, okay, I kind of focus to a minimum till I get to the next object and then come out again. It's not at all like this. I follow this particle set up here, and he's coming in and converging, and then he gets at a defocusing quadrupole, I get bent away from the middle. You can see at every D, I get bent away from the center line of the system. There's a D right there, I get bent away. There's a D right there, I get bent away. At every F, I get bent towards the middle of the system, bent towards the middle right here at the peak, okay? And also, the change in angle depends on my amplitude, right? If I go through the middle of a lens, I don't get bent at all. There's no quadrupole field in the middle of a quadrupole. If I go through a quadrupole at a very large amplitude, I get bent a lot. So here, at least, you can see that things get bent out quite a bit, get bent in quite a bit, and then hardly get bent at all in that defocusing quadrupole. Get bent a little at that focusing, get bent a little more out at that defocusing, but get bent a lot at that focusing, etc. And you can see kind of this is a wave, but it's not a sinusoidal wave. It's kind of, and it's got kind of a long wavelength. In fact, you can see what its wavelength is here. Right? And going from here, where's the next peak of the wave? The next peak of the wave is right there. So I can count the number of periodic photocells, and this oscillation, this long meta-oscillation, is called a Bethatron oscillation. And that is the number of cells per oscillation is that mu. I went through 360 degrees of that envelope oscillation now in 6.5 cells. So it's this picture, this system that Waldo drew in his book that he did not write down the damn phase advance per cell for is 55 degrees. You can draw a picture and calculate it. And that means that if you knew the length between these quadrupoles, you could write down how strong those quadrupoles need to be. You know the mu. You could write down the focal length of those quadrupoles. You could start designing magnets and actually building something that has exactly this optics. Okay? That, why is this a square root of beta? Well, okay, go way, way back to where we were at the beginning with Hill's equation. Remember, the amplitude that I wrote had something like an amplitude times a W, this ansatz that we plugged in, and W squared is this thing that goes like beta. So W, the amplitude actually goes like the square root of this beta function. When I waved my hands and said, oh, the maximum beta is like the maximum beam size, yeah, it is, except it's not just literally beta. Because of this math in here, it turns out to be the square root of beta. And the ansatz that we get, that solution that we got for that periodic system here, that's like W, that was square root of beta, and I folded in the other constant into the A. So the amplitude goes like the square root of beta. So if you want to know how big your beam size is, or how small your beam size is, the ratio of your beam sizes, it goes like the square roots of this beta function, not like the beta function itself. And then that phase just keeps on going and going. That's 360 degrees, and the next one will be 720 degrees. Just keeps on, the phase just goes on and on forever. You now have enough to actually, oh my God, if you were to go out and actually Google something like, oh, I wonder how that accelerator is designed. Oh my God, here's a design manual. Oh my God, here's a picture of beta functions. You now have some idea of what to look at in one of these pictures and understand some things. This is a genuine picture from the design manual of the accelerator that I helped design and build back when I was a little bit older than you. So it's been running for close to over 20 years now. So these are alternating quadrupoles and dipoles. You can see the system is designed to be completely periodic in here, and in fact it is, all this photo stuff, just like regular. And you can now take, okay, that's a beta, and that's a length scale in there, and you can see that, gosh, the cell length is about 30 meters. And in the book, if I were to backstrapolate, I've got formulas for the maximum and minimum of this thing, and I could even calculate from that the phase advance per photocell is about 77 degrees. Okay? So you know enough to open up a design manual and go, hey, that picture looks wrong. No, not really. But still, this also gets to the question of what happens at the ends. And at the ends is where all of the fun happens. Because life is not all just photos. If it was all just photos, accelerators would be really, really boring as well. What you have to have is combinations of systems that break that periodicity at some point. And then, for example, let's say we want to make... What's the biggest problem with photo? What's the biggest problem with these alternating focusing systems? If I want to make the beam really small in one dimension, it's going to be really big in the other. Okay, because they're almost designed like that. They're almost designed to be this kind of asymmetric thing. And where the beams are the same size, neither one is really the smallest it ever gets. One of them is getting smaller while one of them is getting bigger as they're the same size together. So in the next couple sets of lectures, we'll talk about insertions, talk about other things related to these betas and alphas, these lattice parameters at least. But we'll also, in particular, talk about the magic of what happens if you want to make a collider, or you want to make some optical system that makes the beam really small in all dimensions. Takes, you know, literally like frying an ant with the lens and the sunlight, or a leaf, or some other non-living thing, I suppose, for you pacifists out there. There are ways that you can do that using clearly aperiodic sets of magnets, right? This is not going through and just writing out the boundary conditions. Now I've got incoming boundary conditions that are periodic. I've got these outgoing periodic conditions that are more like gosh, I want both beams to be a minimum size, so their divergence, what's the divergence of something at a minimum?
Zero.
Better be zero, right? It better not be exploding. It better, you know, it's got to be exactly at the minimum size. The divergence of the beam has got to be zero. So I've got a minimum beam size, a divergence of zero, and somehow I've got to convert optics that look like that back over to my periodic photo type optics. How do I do that with only six magnets? You'll learn how to do that. We'll do that in another class at least. But for now, I think I've covered what I want to cover for today. You have a good feeling for what the photo lattice looks like and how to interrelate multiplying matrices to betas and alphas and optics. Next class, we'll get into some of the mechanics of what the betas and alphas really mean and talk more about photo and insertions. Then we'll get into emittances. And then it'll pretty much be time for a midterm. And be advised, by the way, it may or may not be good news. I'm a firm believer in the real world being what it is, and therefore all midterms and all tests that I generally give in all classes are open book, open note. Don't call a friend if you can help it. I might shake a finger at you, but you have all of the slides and all of the notes available to you to try and work things out through a midterm. So, and this midterm will look familiar, I have the feeling.
So for the midterm, we can bring in like a laptop?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You should bring in your laptops. I hope you'll bring in your laptops. So, or the book, for example. There's, on the other hand, I'll give you some more hints about the midterm as it approaches. Classes like this, I want the midterm to be something of a formalism. Those of you that have come to class and listen to things should feel comfortable, take it. It's more to penalize those who do not participate or who do not track. So spread that around. And I'll see you on Thursday, assuming I'm still alive.